And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. This hour we visit with the director of the Wharton Business School Center for Human Resources. He's Professor Peter Capelli. He's the author of Why Good People Can't Get Jobs, The Skills Gap, and What Companies Can Do About It. Welcome to you, Professor.
Thank you.
And welcome. Well, here we are, millions of people still out of work. Why are employers unable to find qualified employees? Or are their expectations too unrealistic? Have they become too picky? What's the real problem?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question as to how big and how serious the problem is and how much of it has just been made up in some ways by the media. It's a very exciting story. If you can hear some employers say there's nobody they can find who can do these jobs, that gets a lot of attention. It's a man bites dog kind of story. It's very appealing to the public and particularly to a lot of the policy people to think that the story is that people just don't have the right skills. If you just gave them the right training and education, it would, you know, solve the problem. People could get jobs. Jobs are out there. It sounds nice. And I think it also feeds into this notion that schools are failing. You know, this idea that, well, people can't get jobs because their education is inadequate, and that's the reason. You know, it all sort of fits together into a nice story. The problem is there's no evidence for any part of the story. There's just, unfortunately, no evidence for any part of it. You know, there's no evidence that schools are failing. Actually, schools seem to be doing better over time than they have been. They sort of hit their bottom in the 1970s when I graduated from public school. That was kind of the very bottom of their student performance. You know, in terms of unemployment, most of the people who are unemployed right now are people who were employed just a few years ago. They didn't suddenly lose their skills and abilities.
Right.
There doesn't seem to be any big change in the economy going into the recession, coming out from it. So I think the big change, but it's a very important change, is what employers are doing now and really what they're expecting. That seems to be the big story.
Describe the catch-22 for workers seeking jobs that you talk about in your book.
Yeah, so and just to follow on from the story about what employers are expecting, they want, and you can certainly see why you'd want this, they want people who can immediately step into the jobs and contribute. They don't need training. They don't need ramp-up time. They can just walk right in the door and hit the ground running, as they say. You know, those of us who are older will remember a time when you were left college or left high school. You went to an employer. You immediately went into a training program.
Right.
And the employer would prepare you for the jobs that they needed done. I can certainly remember in the Reagan administration, where I briefly was in the Labor Department, in those days, employers would say, just give me somebody with the right attitudes and we'll train them. The big change now is that they don't want to train. I could understand why not. It's expensive. And they also don't want to have to ramp people up, even if you've had the right training and skills. It takes time to understand the job. They want people who can walk right in. So what everybody wants is experience. We want you to have had this job already. We want you to be working right now. And that's the catch-22 for workers, is in order to get a job, you have to have had a job. And in fact, ideally, you have to have the job right now, and it has to be the same job that we are hiring for right now. And if you don't have that job on your resume, it's unlikely you'll get hired. So that's the catch-22, especially for young people. How do you get experience?
Exactly. And there's another catch-22, because you say that a lot of companies are unwilling to hire unemployed workers.
Right.
So if they're unemployed, how are they supposed to become employed,
right,
if they're not going to be hired?
Right. It's a big problem. You know, it's a, I suppose some people believe it's a form of discrimination. I think the idea behind it is that maybe some of the people who are unemployed actually got fired rather than laid off. It might be true, but you know, it's not during the, you know, the last recession during 2008. It's not like suddenly millions of people were just fired all at once, right? It's pretty clear they got laid off because,
right,
the economy went down. And I think there's some sense that maybe your skills get slightly rusty when you're out of a job for a while. But, you know, these are kind of trivial issues, especially compared to motivation, right? So a lot of the folks who are unemployed are highly motivated, be very grateful to have a job. And if instead what you're trying to hire is somebody who's currently working for your competitors right now, that creates a fake skill shortage, right? If you say, I only want to hire people who are working for my competitors doing exactly the same job now, you do get into a bind there. It's hard to hire those people. They've already got jobs. You got to bid up their wages, and you're not going to find them.
And then, I'm sorry.
We did a program a couple of months ago about people who've been laid off, and I think the guest said that it's an average of 13 months to be reemployed, and the emotional ups and downs that they go through and how depressing it is.
Yeah, it's a terrible experience. You know, it's associated with all kinds of illness, mental illness, physical illness, and certainly emotional distress for you and your families if you're laid off. It's a terrible thing, right? And it's easy to forget about it, but I imagine almost all your listeners know somebody, often in their immediate family, who's been laid off.
And they're living off credit cards.
Yeah, it's a terrible thing.
But I'm thinking many unemployed people take classes, they get additional training. I mean, not all unemployed people are just idle and not getting work. But yet, they're still unemployed, so as far as a prospective employer goes, they still consider them unemployed.
Right. I think the tragedy here, frankly, is that just at the moment still are not enough jobs to go around, and employers can be picky. And that's not surprising. It's not a bad thing. We can't blame the employers for being picky. I think what is pernicious is the idea, though, that we are suggesting that there are not people who could do these jobs, right? And that the people who are unemployed in some ways are kind of unemployable. And that doesn't seem to be true at all. There is no evidence that, the people who are unemployed are not employable. And there's no evidence that the people out there right now can't do jobs.
How does the high cost of benefits affect unemployment?
Well, I mean, you might say that, employers are reluctant to hire people because it's expensive.
Or part-time with no benefits.
Yeah, and it's easier to hire people part-time with no benefits, that's for sure. And I think it's also easier to hire through staffing agencies, right? So the temp industry has actually been doing remarkably well for much longer than in typical recession. So in the past, in a recession, you'd see the temp industry take off because employers first start hiring temps and then eventually hire regular employees. And the reason is temps per hour actually are more expensive to hire than regular employees. You got to pay the temp agency. They have to make money as well, right?
Right.
So, eventually it shifts over, but it hasn't shifted yet. So the temp industry is still booming. And I think the reason for that is employers are afraid maybe still to hire regular employees. Some of it, though, may also be the fact that they are just so picky about what they want. That they're leaving positions vacant for longer, which doesn't really make any economic sense for them. And that's a little hard to understand what's going on.
But don't they have employees who have to pick up the slack when they leave these positions open for all this time? Don't they have employees that they have do other responsibilities? Then the position becomes one that includes the new responsibilities.
Right. And that's another interesting aspect of this story, I think, right, is I think what often goes on in organizations now when they say they can't hire or they're not hiring, is that the manager who has responsibility for profits in each unit, is probably pretty happy not hiring, right? Because if you hire, that hits your bottom line on the cost side. And if you can get your current employees to carry the workload without that extra employee, that's great for you in terms of productivity. So what happens is eventually your employees tell you, look, we just can't do this anymore. We're being burned out trying to do two jobs at once. This is terrible. So the local manager says, okay, we'll hire, right? But he doesn't really want to hire. And so, they keep finding excuses to not hire people. This person's not good enough. And we can't pay that much, right? So what you see happening, and there's good evidence of this in prior recessions, is that job requirements go up, right? So during a recession, understandably, employers get pickier, but they also start to get a little unrealistic as to what they actually need to do a job. And they get unrealistic at the moment about what they have to pay to get it. So the people who have the biggest complaints, surprisingly, are people in human resources right now. And the reason is because they say they can't persuade their hiring managers that the people the hiring managers say they need, first of all, you don't need somebody with that much experience or that much education. And second, you're not going to get them for the wage you want to pay. So the problem they have is trying to persuade their own hiring managers that you can't do it with what you're offering.
Right? So they're offering lower wages. I'm surprised you mentioned human resources departments. I thought they were almost defunct now.
Well, I think that's part of the problem. That's made it worse. And let's talk a little bit about why. People who haven't looked for a job recently probably don't know quite how it works these days. But a lot of the HR people are gone. So the idea that you would meet a recruiter and talk to them about your skills and things doesn't happen very often anymore. The typical model now is that it's all done by software. Applicant tracking systems in particular, which screen resumes, look for keywords. Those things were designed originally to whittle down a huge pool of applicants to a more manageable pool. So a typical employer now may get hundreds of applicants for every position, and a lot of those people on paper look like they could sort of do the job. So what the employers have done in cost-cutting moves is they've gotten rid of a lot of the recruiters. So the HR people are largely, as you say, gone. So the software is handling everything. So somebody actually in Florida sent me a message about their company. They said they had 29,000 applicants for an engineering job, 29,000.
Mm-hmm.
And none of those applicants made it through the applicant tracking software system. So none of them were rated as qualified. Now, how could that possibly be? Well, because the hiring manager builds the software basically and says, I want this, I want this, I want this, I want this. And if you miss any of those requirements, one of them is, for example, the first question on these electronic software things is typically now, what wage are you looking for? So if you're looking for a wage that's higher than they want to pay, your application is thrown out. You're rated as not qualified. And then they ask a series of other questions. And if you miss any one of those questions, your application is thrown out, right? So if you think you got like 10 in a row questions, each with a 50% chance of you getting right, and if you miss any one of them, your application is kicked out, you know, the odds are 1 in 10,000 or so that you're going to make it through the process. So by leaning so heavily on these applicant tracking software systems, which are yes, no gates, recruiters never even get to see the candidate because a lot of them never, most of them never make it through the process.
So there's no human interaction anymore.
Well, yeah. The idea was at the end of this process, you'd have this pool of applicants to look at. But there aren't enough people to look at the pool, even a shrunken pool. So they just crank up the requirements so much that nobody gets through. They don't do it on purpose. I mean, they aren't thinking about, you know, making sure nobody gets through. But once you get these requirements built in and you ask the hiring managers, what do you want? They put in their wish list. You end up with nobody getting through. Mm. And then because of legal reasons, the employer doesn't want to reach back into the pool and start pulling people out because then you treat those people differently and there's a risk that you might discriminate against some people because you're not treating everybody in the pool the same way. So they end up with nobody in the pipeline.
We're speaking with Professor Peter Capelli. He's the director of the Center for Human Resources at the Wharton School. Why Good People Can't Get Jobs is the name of the book on today's Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break, and we'll come back and take some calls and some emails. Stay with us. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper, and we're conversing with Professor Peter Capelli, director of the Center for Human Resources, the Wharton School. Why Good People Can't Get Jobs is the name of his book, The Skills Gap and What Companies Can Do About It. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the number to call is 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-WLRN, or you can email radio at WLRN.org. That's radio at WLRN.org. And just a note, Professor Capelli speaks at Nova Southeastern University's Huizenga Business School this evening at 6:30. You can register online at WhartonSouthFlorida.com. That's WhartonSouthFLA.com. Or you can call 786-206-4867, 786-206-4867. That's to see Professor Capelli this evening at 6:30 in Davie.
Professor, you cite a failure of imagination by U.S. business. Give us some examples.
I think this is around the question of how do you get the skilled workers you need, right? And the failure of imagination, I think, is the idea that the only way to do this is to hire people who are already skilled, able to walk into the job right now, And in part, if you make that your requirement, you bid up wages. It costs more to hire those folks. So a generation ago, you would have seen companies using apprenticeship programs, right, at the hourly level for production employees, skilled trades. That was very common. Apprenticeship programs actually pay for themselves, right?
Because the trades still use that, don't they?
The trades,
like
except
plumbing,
most of those,
carpentry.
Yeah, but most of them have gone away. And the reason they've gone away is that some of them were union programs, and as the unions went down, those programs disappeared. And a lot of employers that used to have them don't have them anymore. They felt maybe they were losing people before they could get their money back out of them. But the need that employers have is somebody who has experience. It's hard to learn this in school. It's hard to become a plumber in a classroom. It's hard to become a manager in a classroom either. You know, it takes practice. And giving people experience is the real need here. Employers say, which is understandable, that it's expensive to do, and we're afraid we're going to lose people if we train them. I think, though, that failure of imagination is not to think through other ways in which you could do it. And there are great examples all the way around the business community. The best one is if you look at professional service firms, like accounting firms, for example. They hire kids out of college, and they turn them into accountants. Some places,
like a paid internship?
No, they're regular employees, but they're working as they're learning, right? So they're working on a project with maybe people in the firm who've been there 2 or 3 years and a senior person. And they delegate the boring tasks to them exactly the way you would see an apprentice working on a job site, right? That
right.
Initially, you're just hauling buckets of stuff around, but at least you're doing something. And then eventually, you learn the process a little bit, and you can do a little more and a little more and a little more. And the employer is billing your time out at more than they're paying you. So accounting firms, law firms, consulting firms actually make money out of these junior people that they're training along the way. The corporations, business, regular businesses never did that. They had different kinds of training programs that were pretty expensive. So, you know, there are ways you can do this. You can rely more on the community colleges to help you. You can actually pay people less while you're training them. There's nothing that prevents you from doing that. There's nothing that prevents you from combining classroom skills that you could learn at a community college or someplace else along with your training program. I think instead what we're seeing is employers saying, look, you know, we're just not going to do it. We're only going to hire people who are already experienced someplace else. If you're the only employer in town who's doing that, that could work great for you. But as soon as everybody starts doing that, it doesn't work for anybody anymore, especially the employees and especially the young people trying to get into the labor market.
Wouldn't older employees meet many of the current needs of employers, or is age discrimination still alive and well?
Yeah, I wrote a book about that a couple of years ago called Managing the Older Worker, and it's a great puzzle why employers were not making greater use of older workers. Evidence seems to indicate that about 3/4 of older individuals approaching traditional retirement age want to keep working in some way, right? They don't want to work maybe as hard. They don't want the same jobs. And only if you can't stay on at your current job, maybe only about 1/3 of those people actually find any other employment, despite the fact they want to.
Mm.
And it seems pretty clear that it is discrimination. The particular heart of the discrimination, I think, is younger supervisors who are afraid to manage older, more experienced
right.
subordinates. And that's what leads to the discrimination. They just don't want to try.
So they don't. They just have a problem because they're older and they're being managed by younger people, but the older people don't have a problem being managed by younger people.
I'd say the bigger problem is the younger people who say, how do I manage this person? They've been doing this job longer than I have. They know more about it than I
right.
do. And, you know, interestingly enough, the place which is best at this is the military now. And the reason, if you think about it, you can see why. For generations, they've had second lieutenants coming out of college and the service academies, 22 years old, put in charge of sergeants who are 45 and are quite experienced. And it was a recipe for a disaster. In fact, it did lead to lots of problems. So they've begun to teach the younger supervisors, in this case, the 22-year-olds coming out of the colleges and the service academies, that you've got to deal with these sergeants differently. You've got to become a partner with them. You're not going to boss them around. You're still in charge. You're still accountable. But you have to engage them in this process of making decisions and make use of them and not try to, you know, tell them what to do all the time,
right,
because they know a lot of
that
stuff.
That would be a little touchy.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Professor Peter Capelli of the Wharton School of Business. If you'd like to join in, our number 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. And also email radio@WLRN.org. First up, we have Charles. He's in Hollywood. Hey, Charles.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Go ahead.
Just wanted to ask the professor about these, I guess, so-called headhunter firms that I guess primarily specialize in top management positions, and how reliable they are, not to the employer, but to the potential employee or applicant. I've heard of situations where announcements have been out for months, where applicants have found out that the position was actually filled from within, and the announcement simply came out to, I guess, protect the employer of potential lawsuits because they didn't open it to the public positions. So someone from within was promoted to this top-level position. But I'm thinking specifically of this well-known firm, Korn Ferry, was complicit in putting this announcement forth, knowing from the beginning that the position had been filled, the person had been selected. Am I reading something that isn't there, or can the professor expand on that a little bit on how the role this these headhunter firms play in the market?
Well, let's maybe back up a little bit and talk about the general context, right? So as companies have made more efforts to bring in the talent from the outside rather than develop it from within, you have these firms that are in the business of trying to make the market, right, trying to help match potential applicants to the companies. There are two types of search firms. One type are called contingency firms. What they do is they only get paid by a client if they give you a resume of somebody that you hire. Those firms basically just gather resumes, and sometimes, you know, they have jobs that are live, and sometimes maybe they got jobs which have already expired. You know, it's hard to know. The other firms are called contingency. Well, first one is contingency, and the other ones are firms that are under retainer, so they call those retained firms. Like Korn Ferry is a retained search firm, and they only engage a client if the client pays them up front, and they pay them whether the job gets filled or not. And often, I think what you're seeing now is even when companies decide that they think they probably would fill a job from within, they still hire a retained search firm to give them a sense of what the market looks like out there, who else could do the job. So it wouldn't be too unusual to have a situation where a retained search firm is looking for candidates for a position, but the company ends up promoting somebody internally anyway because they want to see what the market and the outside looks like. So I wouldn't say that's unusual, and it might not be really unethical. I think they don't know for sure, and the company themselves, the client, doesn't know for sure they're going to do the promotion from within. They're kind of looking around. But it does tell you something about how externally oriented the firms are now, that even when they got somebody they want to promote from within, they want to look around before they do it.
Okay, Charles, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay.
What about hiring from within? Has that diminished?
Well, there's some interesting statistics on this. If you compare it to a generation ago, those of us who grew up in the 60s or 70s, but up through about the 80s, early 80s, virtually all the vacancies inside a typical company were filled from within. So typical figure was about 90% of vacancies inside a company would be filled from within by promotions from within, by lateral moves, that sort of thing. The figure at the moment is something like only a third of positions inside companies are filled from within now. So something like two-thirds of the vacancies are filled by going outside to hire.
And why is that?
Well, that's a very good question. I think the reason is partly that companies feel they've got to move quickly. They don't have time to grow people into roles. I think also they've decided that once they gave up their own training operations because they were expensive and they wanted to move fast. There was very little to promote from within. And then once they started hiring on the outside, you begin to break down your competitors' internal processes as well. So if you've been growing somebody and grooming them for a few years to become an executive, and I'm a company next door and I come in and grab that person away from you, and if I keep doing that for a while, you say, to heck with it, we're not going to grow people anymore. So my outside hiring is your retention problem. And eventually, if you have enough retention problems, you throw up your hand and say, forget it, we're just not going
to. But for some institutions, wouldn't it be good to have outsiders come in with fresh ideas instead of just being instilled in the institutional culture?
Yep, for sure. I think that's right. And I think if you were a company that did no outside hiring, that would be a big problem. I think at the moment, though, if two-thirds of all the people that are all the vacancies in your company are filled from the outside, and you're sort of churning your entire ranks, especially the management ranks, every 3 or 4 years, you know, there's no culture to the place, there's no continuity, there's no institutional knowledge, and it's also very expensive. Let me give you a quick anecdote on the expense. I have a colleague who did a study on this, and he looked at people at the director level in a company, and he compared the people who were promoted from within to the people who are hired from the outside into the identical job. And he found that the people who were hired from the outside, it took them 3 years to become as productive as the people who were promoted from within, right? So you pay a price in terms of productivity if you go outside. The people who were promoted from within, he found it took them 7 years to catch up to the pay given to the person hired from the outside. So when you go on the outside, you pay more and you lose productivity. It still might be worth doing if you want to get new ideas, you want to get, you know, new and different experience, but you're paying a heck of a price for it. And if you're doing it with two-thirds of all your jobs, you got to ask yourself, do we really need that much variety? Do we really need that many new ideas in the organization? I think the answer is probably no. I think you're way overdoing it.
We have an emailer. I don't know if you can help, Joel. He's a high school student. He wants to know how to land a summer job with a large retailer. What should they do or not do?
What should the students do if they're looking for a job?
I'm wondering if he means the large retailer or he himself, but I assume he means...
I imagine it's him. It's
what
it's
he should do.
Him, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we've had an explosion of interest in internships and a real explosion in unpaid internships. They're just all over the place now. And the idea of an unpaid internship is, you know, you're supposed to be learning something. As a student going into that organization, the tricky part is that if you're doing work for the company, you're actually breaking the law if you have an unpaid internship. The law requires that if you're working on behalf of a company, that they pay you.
What law is that?
It's the Fair Labor Standards Act.
But what about if you're in an accredited college program and the employer is also giving grades to an instructor on your internship?
Yeah, so if that's supposed to be maybe the most common approach is where you're doing some things there and you're getting credit.
And it's for a semester or...
Right. Even then, if you are actually doing productive work for the company, you're supposed to be being paid for it, right? Which you don't see happening very often. And in fact, it's getting so competitive. I've heard from at least one person in a college that told me they're companies that are coming to them to do apprenticeships with the college's students are expecting those students to have already done an apprenticeship with somebody else. You can't do an apprenticeship with those companies.
So even that.
Even that, right, unless you've already done an apprenticeship with somebody else.
What about a public institution and then it's not an internship but a volunteer?
Well, you can, again, volunteer. If it's a for-profit organization, I think they have to pay you. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the exemptions are for different kinds of other organizations. Clearly, there are some. You can have unpaid volunteers doing good work for all kinds of charitable organizations. Don't seem to have to pay them.
We have volunteers give station tours here.
Yep, I think you're safe. I'm guessing you're safe. But
docents.
Yeah, docents. But if you're a for-profit organization, it's different. So back to his question, what should you do? I think you need to, well, first you got to figure out whether you expect to get paid or not. But I think if you're willing to volunteer, it's easier. And if you can persuade them that they don't actually have to do very much for you. that you already know how to show up on time, that you already know how to comport yourself on the job. That's certainly the biggest complaint employers have, surprisingly.
A letter of recommendation also.
Yeah. Anything that shows, I mean, it's actually much like getting any other kind of job. You want to show them that you can already do this. You're not going to be a lot of trouble to them. You don't need a lot of ramp-up speed. But, you know, I wanted, if we could, I'd like to pursue this question just a little bit further and maybe speak a little bit to the parents out there, because I think this is one of the big conundrums that this hiring people who've already got the skills raises. So let's say you're a parent and you've got a kid who is in school and wants to pursue a job and a career and wants to do it by going through a college that has a very vocational orientation. So in my town, for example, there's a MBA program that's not mine that offers a master's degree in pharmaceutical marketing. Okay, it's very specific. If you're a parent, do you support that or not? Here's why you might worry about it, right? And that is, what if that kid of yours graduates when that market is down? The pharmaceutical companies are in trouble. What's he going to do then? What happens to her loans? Who's going to pay him, right? When you graduate with a very specific degree, it's exactly what the companies say they want until they're not hiring. And then are you worse off than if you had a more general degree, wasn't as expensive, you didn't spend all that money, right? If you've got a degree in pharmaceutical marketing and you're trying to get a job in a bank, are they going to look at you and say, well, I'm sorry, you just don't fit? Would you have been better off?
Is that why MBAs are so popular now?
Well,
there's versatility there.
Yeah, the reason MBAs are so popular, frankly, is because companies are no longer giving management training that they used to give that was almost the equivalent of an MBA degree. So they'd rather you pay for it yourself.
Right.
They'll pay you more when they hire you, but if they don't want to hire you, of course, they don't pay, right?
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@WLRN. We have Steve in Hollywood. Thanks for your patience, Steve. Hi.
No problem. Good morning. And I just want to say it's nice to hear Peter hit on all these, hitting these nails on the head, all these conundrums and all these kind of dog chasing his own tail kind of things. I just wanted to point out, and it kind of talks to what Peter was just talking about apprenticeships and whatnot, that Germany, I think, is by far the leading manufacturing country in Europe. And it's because they've had the apprenticeship programs in place for decades. And the thing that I think is very curious, and haven't heard anybody talk about it here in the States, is Angela Merkel has proposed that they're going to reduce high school from 4 years down to three, which is going to put those productive people into those jobs much quicker than anybody else is doing. And to contrast that with, and I don't know the exact number, but we see a proliferation of these pop-up overnight online schools here that seem to me to be kind of more a money grab, because we know that we can get students in the door. Even if they don't come for the full semester, they've got some money from the student, they got some money coming back from the government on these retraining programs and educate ourselves and whatnot. And it seems to me that from a manufacturing standpoint, Germany is really headed down the right road, where we're missing the boat, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Thanks for that call. I think that certainly is a conundrum. I think people in the rest of the industrial world are always puzzled by the U.S. because we're so bad at apprenticeships. We have the lowest incidence of them in the developed world, for sure. In fact, the U.S. government doesn't publish statistics on them anymore. I think they still collect them, but we don't even know how few we have. We just know that if you look industry by industry, they seem to have collapsed. If you look at countries like Europe, though, it's difficult for us to mimic what they've got, particularly in countries in Scandinavia where they're also big, is they can get all the major employers in a room together. And they can say, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to do apprenticeships. We're all going to agree that we won't hire and poach talent from each other. We'll let everybody finish the programs along the way. And we're all going to do this because we all benefit from it. And they can get agreement among the employers to do that. In the U.S., it's hard to do.
Isn't that collusion, though?
Sorry, what?
Isn't that a form of collusion?
Sure, it's a form of collusion. And, you know, I'm sure the government looks the other way on that or doesn't care about that kind of collusion, right? Since you're not competing, I guess, in quite the same way as if you were selling stuff. Right. So it's not price collusion in that way. But I think those, and those are smaller countries too, right? And it's sort of easier to do. In the U.S., one of the things people don't recognize is that both education and training in the U.S., the federal government has very little role in it, right? It's a state and local operation. The federal budget for education is tiny. Maybe only a couple of percent of K through 12 education is funded by the federal government. It's state and local operations that do it. And part of the problem is state and local are in competition with each other. And if you're in a state that butts up against another state, like you look at my state, like Philadelphia's just as close to Delaware and New Jersey as it is to most of the rest of Pennsylvania. Suppose Philadelphia says, we're going to invest big time in an apprenticeship program. And the employers in New Jersey and Delaware say, yay, great idea. We'll just yank those people away as soon as you train them, right?
Can I jump in for
sure, yeah.
Because what I'm trying to say is I think it should be, and I don't know that it's not in Germany, but I don't think this should be from the government at all. I think the companies are missing the boat by saying, hey, look, maybe a kid doesn't want to go to – most kids that hit the senior level are thinking about maybe not most, but a lot are saying, hey, I'm kind of fed up. And maybe if they had an opportunity to go out and make some money, and I don't think that should be a government program or a government-assisted program. I think that should be something that corporations look at, and I think that that's what actually happens in Germany. I may be wrong about that. But if I'm a, if I'm an employer and I can find people that are going to be productive for me for the next 30 years and be happy in those jobs as long as I'll train them, that seems to be a more a much more productive system than hey, go out there and try to find some money for school and like you said, the very specific get a very specific degree and then walk into a bank and they what the first thing they think is, well, he's overqualified and he's, you know, it's not going to be a good fit. So I'm thinking it should be something that the corporation should be looking to do.
Yeah,
I think it would be if I was looking to hire people.
Yeah, I think so. And you're right. In most of Europe, these are largely privately run arrangements. And in the U.S., they used to be privately run as well. They just don't seem to happen. And part of the reason, though, is to do with the economic geography of the U.S. and the fact that it's hard to get groups of employers together. It's hard to get them to bind themselves to an agreement. And it's also difficult because of geography-wise such a big country, you can't get everybody in the room together. And if you only get a small group, there's always employers around the outside of you who could yank these folks away. But I agree, it's way underused. It would make a lot of sense for U.S. firms to do this more. We know these programs work. We know they address exactly what employers say they want, which is work experience.
We're speaking with Professor Peter Capelli, Director of the Center for Human Resources at the Wharton School, why good people can't get jobs, the skills gap, and what companies can do about it. We'll still take your calls and your emails. First, a short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. We continue our conversation with Professor Peter Capelli. We have a few phone lines open, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, email radio at WLRN.org. Bonnie, a reminder about the Wharton Club event?
Yes. It's at NSU's Huizenga Business School. That's Nova Southeastern University's Huizenga Business School in Davie. The professor will be speaking at 6:30 p.m., and you can register either online at WhartonSouthFLA.com. That's WhartonSouthFLA.com or at 786-206-4867.
Professor, how about advice for parents who have youngsters that are ready to enter the job market?
You know, it's a terrible bind right now. And let me tell you, I have an unemployed son. Graduated from college with a class.
You have an unemployed son.
I have an unemployed son who's
and the dentist son,
yeah, right, who's got a classics degree, which doesn't make him very employable. But I'll tell you a little bit about his experience. Right, we realized he wasn't going to march into the job market being able to translate ancient Greek. This wasn't going to do a lot for him. So he went back to a community college and got one of these certificates in a particular healthcare field. You know, healthcare was supposed to be hot and. So he did that, and then we discovered that nobody hires people right out of school with those certificates anymore, that the market is saturated with
people. So I assume he's still at home.
Right. He's still on the family payroll. One of the things that's happened is just having the certificate doesn't necessarily get you a job anymore, that you need experience. And the reason is there's just not enough of these jobs to go around. Kids are killing themselves, and a lot of their parents too, trying to figure out what makes sense for your kids. So let's think about that a little bit, because we got a terrible conundrum in the U.S. right now, and that is, if you look at the gap between what a high school graduate makes and a college graduate makes, that gap is growing. But the reason it's growing is because the wages for high school graduates, people with only high school degrees, is collapsing, right?
There's very little manufacturing.
Yeah, there's little manufacturing. There's little that you can work your way up into with a high school degree.
Right.
And part of the reason for that is the college graduates can take the good high school graduate jobs, right?
Right?
If you're a college graduate, you can do a job that used to be done by high school people. In fact, that's pretty common now. So that gap is growing, which means if you don't go to college, you're really going to get whacked. On the other hand, the actual wages for college graduates are declining as well. They're just not declining as fast as they are for high school graduates, right? So that means that it's hard to pay the loans back, right? So, you know, it's a heck of a conundrum for a parent. What do you do? And especially if your kid has, as we were saying before, an interest in something that is highly specific. So, for example, look at the field of
esoteric.
Let's say even employable. So think about something like IT computer programming, right? Microsoft has been making a lot of noise and has been for a decade about difficulty finding people with the right computer programming skills they want to hire. So should you encourage your kid to do that? Right, follow those jobs. Oh, lots of good paying jobs there. Well, the problem is that's been a highly cyclical occupation. The IT goes up and down in terms of demand. And also those jobs don't last very long, that the skills you get in college, immediately useful, but they don't last very long. The technology changes, the programming skills change, they don't build on each other. So maybe you got 5 years if you happen to hit the market right.
If you happen to hit it.
So if you're a parent, are you then like a venture capitalist? You're trying to say, okay, which field should we invest in our kid for? What are the odds that this is going to pay off? And nowadays it's hard to know. Like nursing, for example, right? The nursing shortage in most parts of the U.S. is over. In my city, the guess is that only about half the graduates of nursing programs get jobs now. Right.
And we haven't even touched on student loan debt.
Oh, which is, you know, going up, and it's going up faster because people aren't getting jobs that allow them to pay it off, you know. So if you're a parent, how do you play all this out? And it's a terrible bind.
Yeah, because you're not profits. You don't know what's going to be the hottest field.
But you do know that now, unlike in the past, there's incredible risk, right? And that is, it could very well be the degree that your kid has been launched in won't pay off for anything. Mm. It could be that your kid has a liberal arts degree and nobody's particularly interested in that degree. But on the other hand, if you get a highly specific vocational degree, and certainly that's been the trend to move toward those degrees,
right,
it's quite possible that you don't time the market quite right on that, and then you end up with nothing.
I want to go back to something you said earlier. You were talking about the young high school student, and you were saying if he knows how to comport himself and he knows all those things already in getting a job. And then you said something was the biggest complaint that employers have. And what was that?
Yeah, you know, people think that employers are complaining about students having poor academic skills. They're not. And in fact, they never have, at least in modern times since I've been looking at the data, which has been back to the early 80s, their complaints are always, including now, about attitudes. It's about discipline, self-discipline. It's about being able to show up on time. It's about getting along with people. It is all about things that we call the soft skills. And by the way, that's been true for a long time, right? So I think if you are trying to persuade an employer and you're young that they should hire you, that's the thing to push on, you know, that you've demonstrated you can show up on time, that you can get things done, that you get along with other people, those sorts of things.
That's important.
Yep.
And in this digital age, though, it seems that young people are losing those soft skills that you call them.
Well, it could be. You know, I think there is a tendency, and I'm not suggesting that you're saying this now, but I know a lot of people are, to suggest that kids today are different in ways that are worse. And those of us who are older, and I'm looking around our studio here, and I guess we're all baby boomers in the room here, right? We can remember that our parents had a view about what we were like when we were young, which was not very flattering, right?
Right.
Parents thought we were the laziest, right, most unkept, ungrateful generation ever. Maybe they were right. I don't know. We grew up to be the workaholic generation, right? And if you look at the actual data about kids today versus kids 10 years ago and their attitudes 10 years before that, they're really not very different. They're really pretty similar. And I think we sort of overplay this idea that there are these big generation gaps and big differences in kids and their attitudes toward work. They've been the same more or less since the baby boomers. And they
people
probably
that were set in their ways tend to have those kind of views. And
well, as we get older, I think we forget what it was like to be 22. And I understand this is true even back in ancient Greece, that the ancient Greeks used to complain about the younger Greeks, right? That they don't have the same attitudes and all that stuff, right?
I just wanted to talk about one other thing. I read this article about employee, a lack of employee loyalty. But isn't it related to the lack of employer loyalty?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I wrote a book about that in 1999, which called The New Deal at Work. And it's very clear what happened. Employers and employees used to have a lifetime agreement. If you looked at U.S. tenure in a job, it was the same up until about mid-80s as it was in Japan. We thought Japan had lifetime employment. We had it here effectively too. Employers broke the deal in the early 80s by laying off people and then laying them off not just when the market was down but whenever they were restructuring and not hiring them back, which used to happen, right? Layoffs were always temporary. In fact, the government didn't even keep track of permanent job loss until 1985 because the assumption was if you were laid off, you'd get hired back. So employers, you know, let people go when they don't need them, but we understand why they do that. They hire in new people when they do need them. We understand why they do that. But it's not surprising that employees assume that now, and so they're looking out for themselves.
Right. Well, I just want to mention again that Professor Peter Capelli will be speaking at Nova Southeastern University's Huizenga Business School this evening at 6:30. You can register online at WhartonSouthFLA.com, WhartonSouthFLA.com, or at 786-206-4867.
And we'll have a link about Professor Peter Capelli's book titled Why Good People Can't Get Jobs, The Skills Gap, and What Companies Can Do About It. It's been a great pleasure to meet you, Professor Peter Capelli, and the best to you. And thanks for giving a really interesting hour.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening this hour. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our Topical Currents producer is Richard Ive, technical supervision by Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Remember, we have free audio archives and downloads of this and past programs at our website, WLRN.org. More information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program is about employee rights and recourses. We'll visit with a panel of experts and, of course, take your calls. And today's calendar, all music. On this day in 1925, 88 years ago, the birth of jazz sax giant James Moody in Savannah, Georgia. Moody's Mood for Love. He performed two live broadcast concerts on WLRN in the 1990s. He died in 2010. And on this day in 1928, 85 years ago, the birth of Antoine Fats Domino in New Orleans. Ain't That a Shame? Walking to New Orleans and Poor Me. He was rescued by a Coast Guard helicopter in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. One more while we walk the line. On this day in 1932, 81 years ago, the birth of country music giant Johnny Cash, the man in black, in one of my favorite towns, Kingsland, Arkansas. His first band was called The Barbarians. And we leave with this thought, fitting for today's topic. From Fats Domino, His Fat Man single in 1949 may well have been the first rock and roll record. Quote from Fats, "A lot of fellows nowadays have a B.A., M.D., or Ph.D. Unfortunately, they don't have a G.O.B. This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.